Oh, yeah, that's right. I am reviving, single-handedly reviving the era of Boogaloo. If you're from the Bronx or anywhere in New York, you know what Boogaloo is. That's composer, arranger, vocalist, and trombonist Johnny Colon, the great Johnny Colon, on glorious 1967 vinyl, leading his orchestra with Boogaloo Blues. Colon combined Latin, soul, and blues intonations and sparked the Boogaloo craze of the 1960s. Boogaloo Blues, by the way, was his debut album and also his first major hit. In 1968, he founded the East Harlem Music School, which spawned new generations of salseros. So here's a shout out to you today, Johnny Colon. Hope you're in good health. This is Lead Stories. I'm Eutrice Lead. It is Friday, June the 20th. I'm not ready for this month to be over. But it is Free Your Mind Friday, and it is your time to say what's on your mind. So let's get started at 888-874-4888. Let's hear your very, very strong opinions and analyses of major issues and events and other things you think warrant closer attention today. We start off in California with Harvey.
Hello, wonderful Eutrice.
Hello, wonderful Harvey. How are you doing today?
Everything's great. I feel wonderful. And I want to talk first the good news. I want to talk about the virtues of solar energy today and going solar. And the good news, there's an article today that says Germany produced a record 50% of its electricity needs through solar panels at the start of June, breaking a huge milestone. And, you know, like Germany is a heavily industrialized country, and they've now gotten 50% of energy from solar. So that's, I just want to commend them for doing that. And it's not the brightest spot on Earth either, so they've really been into it. And the reason that I think that it's going solar, or some of the reasons, are that, number one, once manufactured, solar panels use no water. It turns out that coal, oil, natural gas, and nuclear power are second only to agriculture in their daily use of our freshwater resources. And once manufactured, as I mentioned, solar panels use no water. They make no noise. You know, we live in such a noisy, there's noise pollution. It's just terrible. Solar panels make no noise. They have no moving parts, nothing to wear out. Over their 20 to 25 year warranty, they create no CO2 emissions. They don't add to the greenhouse gases like fossil fuels. And interestingly enough, when placed on the rooftop of a large warehouse building, the owner found that the solar panels reduced heating and cooling costs because they created a sort of a membrane in between the rooftop and the solar panels that that saved the building owner money. And also, every 8 to 10 years, rooftops have to be repaired or replaced due to ultraviolet radiation. And this extended the solar electric roof panels, extended the life of the roof. So it really served the building owner well to have solar panels on the rooftop. And lastly, they don't come with sirens and evacuation plans like nuclear plants. But the thing is, now we're coming into the era of electric cars, and of course you want to plug your electric car into your solar rooftop. If you just plug it into the fossil fuels, it kind of defeats the purpose. So you want to put a solar electric rooftop on or installation on your rooftop that runs the power for both your house and your car. And the beautiful part is with the escalating costs of gasoline, including wars. You know, like right now, the average price for gasoline is about $4 a gallon. But if you throw in what I call the war tax, the war for oil tax, and it was said that the Iraq war cost $1 billion. So you're paying sort of half at the pump, out of your pocket, $4 a gallon.
More than $1 trillion it cost.
And you're paying like I estimate another $4 through your tax dollars. So really, it's like $8 a gallon, as far as I'm concerned, for the true cost of gasoline. And so, like, once you, if you're saving like over the 20-year warranty of the solar panels, if you're saving all that fuel, then that's like a lot of, we're talking about a lot of money, and it makes the payback on the rooftop about 5 years, and then you have another 15 or 20 years of electricity for your, both your house and your car. And it also makes the house more saleable. It turns out houses with solar panel, solar insulation sell faster because it comes with 20 years of utility for both your car and your house. So I think those are just some of the reasons. Plus, most of the wars we fight are for commodities like oil and fossil fuels. So if we want to slow down war, if we want to get away from all this, the best thing you can do as an individual is put solar panels on your rooftop and, or join in some collective group that put places solar panels on somebody else's rooftop and sells the power online. So I say it is time to get star powered, and I say let's get solar, Utrecht.
Absolutely agreed. I think that's a great idea. And, you know, apart from everything else, the fact that if Germany has reached this milestone, it means it also has this shift has provided jobs while, a new infrastructure and a new alternative is being built. And that's also a benefit. Thanks so much for calling today.
Thank you.
From Dallas, Texas. It is Sarah. And by the way, the number is 888-874-4888. It is Free Your Mind. Sarah, free your mind.
Greetings to you, Utrecht.
Thank you. And to you, too.
Yes, Utrecht. Greetings to you and the PRN listening audience. And I would like to wish everyone an enjoyable weekend. Utrecht, to expand a little bit more on what we were speaking on yesterday with the Clintons and what's going on globally with them and their involvement, their fingers being in all of that's going on with the mess that was created by them. Because, as I said before, Hillary Clinton and all of them that started this mess, a continuation of all of the policies that was started from the Reagan administration on down, with each administration adding on a bit more and expanding, because all this is pointing to us and showing us, Utrecht, this is all about one small group trying to control all of the natural resources on the planet. It is being consolidated into the hands of just one particular group, and we know at the top of that chain it's white men who are in charge of this group, who are trying to control and dictate as to how it is this resources is going to be consolidated. They're of course going to be in charge of it. And they're going to decide, you know, how much it is that you're going to be spent in order to get it. And we are seeing that with all of this wars and skirmishes, because whenever I hear that word peace, you treat a humanitarian, I'm looking at a ground invasion. Because these people are not concerned about peace. You know, this English language is very duplicitous. When they say peace, you need to talk about pieces. Like, you know, you're going to see a whole lot of body parts. Because they always like to throw those terms that, this is a humanitarian effort. We have all of these things to go in here. But if it's a humanitarian effort, why are you using drone technologies to bomb people from the sky where you are not sure what you're hitting on the ground is really what you're doing? Look at that, the young man in Yemen that happened about 40 years ago, the 60-year-old child who went looking for his father that they branded was a terrorist. You know, U.S. citizens born in the United States went back to Yemen, and they killed the young man sitting at an outdoor cafe with his cousin, and they just dropped the Volkswagen on top of the cafe and obliterated this young man. You know, these are the things that are being done, and they're always talking about we are trying to prevent terrorism from coming to the U.S. shores. But you know what? You're over 5,000 miles away in another continent creating trouble over there. These people are over there, you are the ones who are creating so-called 9/11 situations. Because you are keep the pot stirring and keep it going. And I'm sick and tired of people always like to say that, you know, you need to learn to forgive and forget. The United States is not doing no forgive and forget reconciliation. They are remembering and they're going after their so-called adversaries and their enemies, and they're trying to kill them and all future generations from off the planet. But yet still, they always like to turn back on black people and say, okay, we need to learn to forgive. We need to learn to forget. It's always based upon the victim, telling the victims what it is that we need to do, controlling the narrative of how we're supposed to feel and how we're supposed to react in our oppressed state. And that is very, very offensive. And it's the same thing that we are seeing doing across this planet, where they are doing all of these atrocities that they are doing, and they're expecting that these people who they're doing these things, and that these people are supposed to turn the other cheek, they're the only ones who's supposed to be forgiven while they keep getting oppressed and these things keep happening to them over and over again. It's all about greed. It has always been about greed to see how much that they can have and how much they can control. And the rest of us whose resources it really is, we're supposed to just grin and bear it because we should be glad that the Europeans are in here and they're extracting the resources. That is why when I hear you, Therese, that, you know, Harvey means well and he's talking about, you know, the solar paneling and, you know, extracting energy from the sun and these things that we need to do, he means well. But to me, what I'm seeing through when Europeans, I think they talk about conservation, I'm seeing them only trying to conserve for themselves. They're not concerned for the rest of the planet because you have a small group of people, especially in the United States, where they're extracting more resources. They're extracting double the energy and the resources that they're using compared to the rest of the planet. People in China and India are not using as much as the people in the United States here use. So it's always about conserving and preserving things only for a specific group. It's not for anybody else. Because you
So far, you've touched on about 463 different topics. Have you been keeping
track? My mind is very free today.
You know, I got to tell you, I like your technique. You start off by telling us what you will be talking about. And you should have about, you know, a whole bunch of space, and then the word eventually should end that sentence. Here's what I'm going to be talking about eventually.
But you, Therese, I feel very light now. I've lost quite a few pounds.
Well, yes. Well, thank you so much. Thank you, ma'am, sir, for your call. But, you know, of course, you're raising very legitimate points on all of the subjects. The question ultimately, Sarah, is what, therefore, is the role of the community in all of this? In as much as all of this is affecting, I mean, it comes down to a community level and a community of people, what should the response be?
The response should be, you three, we cannot sit back and wait on government. We have been sold this social service thing that, you know, everything is based on government. Somebody higher and smarter than you is going to be taking care of you. And that is not true. You know, nobody could know your body and your issues better than you, Utrecht. And we have got to stop passing on what is our responsibility onto some elected officials thinking that they're going to do it for us. They're not. They're in the pockets of the corporations who are funding their campaigns, and they are never, ever going to address our policies better than you at a grassroots level who know exactly what's going on with you.
So what should the community do?
The community needs to fight back. We need to handle our business ourselves. We need no longer sit back and wait on these officials to do it for us. We need to get out here like we see all across the Middle East, and these people, they're reactionary. They get out there and they do things. They're not sitting back waiting for people to come and do it for them. But we have lost these retreats. I could honestly say that the presidency of Barack Obama has set us back more than 50 years. It has set us back. It has really set us back globally because everybody is so enamored with this black man and this family that it has totally knocked the spunk out of everybody, the energy out of us. It has been totally sucked up because white people don't want to offend it because if they say something against them, black people are going to jump and defend them based on race. Black people don't want to say anything because they want this black first black man have a successful presidency. So it has totally derailed us. The train is off the tracks. The tracks have been ripped up. We're going to really have to reconstruct this all over again.
Well, thanks a lot for your call today.
You're welcome, Utrecht.
So far, you always give us something to ponder. It is Free Your Mind Friday on Lead Stories, 888-874-4888. You can also communicate your views on leadstories@gmail.com. And we have a short advisory from Nathaniel to Harvey. And he says, Harvey should start a practical development venture capitalization fund to fund all our progressive energy and environmental products, services, and policy changes needed to bring these development into being. He's talking, of course, about solar power. And that's a suggestion to you, Harvey, that you do something and basically launch and actualize your ideas and begin that process. So there you go. One wonderful reaction. You know, it's an interesting thing how events are unfolding and whether we are able to make sense. But people are we are just so stressed. We're fighting so many things all at the same time. It is so hard to focus on, you know, getting things done and at the same time doing the work that's necessary to make the path for the next generation a little less complicated and a lot less unfair and onerous. But still, this is the nature of life. And compared to what others have been through, really, it's not that tough. when you read about the kinds of things that people had to put up with in their daily lives in the United States, let alone around the developing world, you see, in a sense, that it's comparatively easy. We have a lot more advantages, and therefore we have fewer excuses about our lack of involvement and our lack of exercising our civic duty to be part of the educated electorate that in fact takes its rights seriously enough to reaffirm this authority we ought to have over the throttle and brake of government, that we should be able to stop it when we insist that it stop, and we should be able to make it go when we want it to go. But we've become very complacent and cowardly in a way. We've become absorbed in our own lives and in our own narrow interests in our own little corner of the world. And we engage in these things largely on a theoretical level as opposed to the applied science of knowledge. If you have knowledge, how are we applying it in a way that makes life better, that improves conditions in our society, that advances the cause of justice? These are some of the issues that we have to deal with. These are the contradictions that we have within the so-called progressive community. People still operating on that paradigm that ought to be destroyed. It's the same thing. The United States foreign policy today is operating on the same hegemonic paradigm of imperialism. We are ordained by the great almighty God himself, or herself, if you're into gender equality, to be the eternal rulers of the world. This is terrifying stuff. On a psychological level, the thing that informs action globally, in European nations especially, in the twisted minds of the jihadists, in crazy people, extremists doing these awful and just horrible things, in despots and authoritarian governments that are literally slaughtering their people and facilitating the slaughter of people. These inhumane things are, when you look at it, you see the frightening truth that they're not isolated, nor are they rare. And in every instance, they were very successful for a long period of time in squashing any opposition. But if you look at the tenor of the times now, you see that there's some bright spots in terms of the power of an irate electorate, basically changing the predictable patterns of their out-of-control governments. They are out in the streets now. They're getting it that their lives are intertwined with the people who they were supposed to be separate and apart from. You know, this notion in the United States that at one point middle class Well, middle class went through revolutionary change. They're now realizing that they're not at all middle class anymore. They're now identifying the reality that they're living the way that they didn't expect to be living as those people in the underclass that they used to look down on. Now they're there. So they have to react. And they're becoming conscious in a very interesting way. So we're seeing some of that, but of course I don't worry about, in our race-based society, whites, let's face it, have options. People of color in the United States don't have many options at all, if any. And so the concern is, within the so-called progressive community, if there is going to be a change, if the opportunity does present itself as it does now to create change, does it not also present the opportunity to change the paradigm of change, to insist on democracy of change, to insist on equanimity of change, to insist on equality of consequences of change, beneficial change, that is. Just your thoughts. 888-874-4888. Of course, we know that the Iraqi government has petitioned. Well, this is the story. This is a storyline. They are now asking the president to reconsider his very neatly defined reintroduction into Iraq. They're asking him for help, the Air Force and other heavier help. Well, of course, we know what this is. This is how it's positioned. They will have the news stories will carry the headlines that the government is asking for more help than Barack Obama is willing to give. Now, of course, that is, we know that that's the help that he wants to give, but he cannot say that. So they will have the Iraqi government and others petitioning and demanding that he come up with a more substantive response, which is to say, to reinitiate a war. And just the same, I mean, they're containing this story very, very effectively, as if to suggest this essentially is about, you know, Muslims kind of fighting among themselves with deadly consequences and grave consequences to others. But we are still not talking about what the real impetus here is. What will make Barack Obama change his mind? First of all, you know, they say, well, Barack Obama ended the war, and we have to be very careful and technical about that. It's not that he ended the war in Iraq, it's that he withdrew the troops from Iraq, but changed the methodology of war. War is now different. Now, you see, these are technical things, and they matter, because for the record, the president will be able to defend himself as the person who has fulfilled the campaign promise to end the war, and the truth will be on his side, because he'll say, look, he withdrew all these troops, therefore the war has ended. No. The withdrawal of the troops heralded a new technological kind of warfare. So the troops were withdrawn, and that's a great psychological boost. And the record will reflect that he is the president who ended the war. But, you know, with the withdrawal of the troops has come massive incursion into countries in different ways, through drones, drone attacks, through the funding of covert groups, through destabilization efforts in other ways. So war is being fought differently. So we have to be careful when these things are said, and we have to understand that everybody's running a game, essentially, and be on the alert. From Los Angeles, DX, you're on the air.
Hello, Eutrice.
Hello.
How are you today? Hello. Greetings to everyone in the PRN audience and the listeners on right now. I was just observing how this is being handled, this whole Iraq thing is being handled in the media. And as you know, I called last Friday and I was talking about how the media gives instant credibility to some certain things and then basically serves as a stonewall on everything else that doesn't fit the corporate agenda. And it's very, very instructive if you look at how they're handling this whole mess in Iraq. So they start out with a narrative. But first of all, let's review what's going on here in this country now. It's a total mess. Got sectarian violence going on. You got Al-Qaeda in Iraq now. All of this was caused because of the U.S. invasion. Let's go over what the narrative is in the media, though. It's totally the opposite. According to the media, Iraq is a mess right now because the great, noble United States tried to go in and establish democracy, but these hard-headed, stubborn Arab people just don't get it, and they don't want democracy, and they can't govern themselves because, look, Obama pulled most of the troops out, and they can't govern themselves. The other part of the narrative is that this sectarian violence that's going on there is a spillover from Syria, and I think they're going to try to use that as more strength to try to invade Syria, that right there. Then another part of the narrative that they have going is the only lives that matter is the 4,000, 5,000 lives lost, American lives lost. Of course, we feel sorry for those families. Nobody's saying we don't. Soldiers, you know, we feel sorry for these young kids who are probably average age about 21 who have lost their lives. I think there's been over 4,500 of them. We do feel sorry for that. I'm not saying that we don't, but some estimates have it as high as 750,000 Iraqis who have been killed. No mention of that. So the narrative here is that despite all of our noble efforts to try and help this country out, we see the mess that we see because these people just can't get it right. Now, we're talking about before the United States went in, one of the most, probably the most advanced country in the Middle East, and they basically bombed them back to pre-industrial times. Now, this narrative in the media is why I say that they deserve no kind of respect. We shouldn't even pay attention to them. Now look at what else they're doing. We hear from the same people first of all, let's clear up that narrative. Just to be clear, Iraq is a mess right now because of the United States invasion. Not in spite of, it's because of. And sectarian violence is a direct result of U.S. interference and invasion. So that's what it really is. But they're never going to let the average public hear anything like that. So what they're doing also is they're talking to some of the same pundits and the same officials, ex-officials, like Bill Kristol, the neocon analyst, and Laura Ingalls, and, you know, Paul Wolfowitz, one of the guys in this mess. And as you pointed out, you got to hear from the Clintons. What do they think? And as you pointed out as well, Bill Clinton was the one who basically started this mess back in the 90s and endorsed it when Bush
and started the bombing. He started the right. Immediately after the act was passed was 4 straight days of bombing.
Right. And you see, the media is giving them instant credibility. All these idiots who got us into this mess, and they're the main reason that this country screwed up now, but the media goes right back to them, gives them instant credibility again. They know what they're talking about. Oh, these guys are the experts on it. Let's talk to them. Well, why? I mean, they're the ones who did it. So another thing is they use they block out anything that's going to shed any light, because I don't know if you've heard of it or not, but sometimes I read the New York Times and other newspapers online. And this past Sunday, Chelsea Manning had a byline in there. I guess they did an interview with her, and she shed
some more light on. She wrote an op-ed piece.
Right, it was an op-ed piece, right.
Mm-hmm.
And amongst it, I won't go into everything that was detailed there, but amongst the things that she pointed out was that during this invasion, in the time that she worked, she was in charge of sort of the media relations and public relations aspect of it, and she said that, among other things, the U.S., the embedding process in Iraq for journalists who get embedded was heavily slanted in favor of journalists who were going to write friendly articles and deliver the narrative that they wanted on the war, which we already probably knew that. Also, that the internal assessments from generals and other people on the ground, other personnel, was way worse than what they were letting on in the media from the beginning. It was more, way more dire. And also, she pointed out that U.S. military intelligence actually was assisting Nouri al-Maliki in his crackdown, his brutal crackdown of his political opponents. The U.S. was actually helping him to do that. So those are some key points, and those are pretty important, but we get no recognition of that. It was in the New York Times, but no mm-hmm. recognition of it on TV, on the major media outlets or anything like that. CNN, I think, mentioned it once or twice, but nowhere else. So my point is, this is how they shape a narrative, and this is how they block out anything that's going to put any truth around, anything that doesn't conform to the narrative, the message that they're trying to get across.
Well, what Chelsea Manning did say in that op-ed piece, Chelsea Manning being the soldier who basically leaked
mm-hmm.
thousands and thousands of files. I'm just saying this for the benefit of people listening about the war in Afghanistan and Iraq, and of course was brought to trial and is currently serving a 35-year sentence.
35 years, yeah. Mm-hmm.
But what Chelsea Manning pointed out in that piece was this process called embedding. And embedding is when the military would give permission for reporters to report on a war.
Right.
This is a formal process. They have to go through a vetting process to find out whether they would be reporting essentially what the military tells them to report, and they sign a form saying, yes, we will do your bidding. And so many times when you see these reporters reporting from the battlefield and so forth, these are embedded reporters who essentially are agents of the military, posing as independent journalists. And they travel, and therefore, if they tell any story that is not does not sing the praises of the military, or that in any way tarnishes the military, their privileges are revoked. This, of course, raises a question about free speech. It raises also about the ethical conduct of the media itself. Why would they choose to agree to this way of reporting on a war? But that was the point that Chelsea Manning was making in that editorial.
Right, and thanks for clearing that up, because I was trying to just go through a few points but you explained it very well. It's absolutely correct. And the most important point she made was about military intelligence actually helping this guy, Nouri al-Maliki, who is the installed prime minister or leader, or who was installed by the U.S. The U.S. was helping him to crack down on his political opponents, which no doubt is part of this sectarian violence back and forth, because as we know, the Sunnis and Shias over there haven't gotten along for a long time. So this mess, the bottom line is this mess was caused by U.S. invasion, and now we have the same people, including the Clintons and all these other neocons, coming around trying to say what should happen and what Barack Obama should do and this and that. And this is what I mean about the media giving people who don't deserve it the instant credibility. Even though we've already seen these people have no idea what they're doing, what they're talking about, you know, we have to go through another round of this nonsense of them being the experts, quote unquote.
Well, this opportunity, I agree with you wholeheartedly. I see no reason to disagree with you on any of your points. The situation now is that there will be a triangulation on the part of the United States, because there are three very important targets. Bill Clinton started out with the concept of dual containment of both Iraq and Iran. That was supposed to protect the interests of the Saudis and the Israeli government. And for good measure, Syria is now going to be thrown in. So that is really what is the daunting task of the Obama administration, how to sell it. They know they're going to do it because they haven't stopped. This is the thing. They haven't stopped doing this.
Right.
Well, this war has been going on, and I want people to be real clear about this. Barack Obama withdrew the troops. That does not necessarily mean that he ended the war. He simply withdrew the troops.
And he didn't even withdraw all of them either. He withdrew most of them. But
you still have to ask yourself a question. How is it possible that of all the embassies that the United States has around the world, The embassy in Baghdad is the largest, with more than 5,000 employees. Mm-hmm, what accounts for that?
Yeah.
So you see how the interests have never really faded. The methodology of war has changed. And I don't know if you recall, myself, I'm having difficulty. I must look it up to remember a tape I shared about the new kind of warfare and how it is going to be fought and around areas near the sea, and how it is going to be a very highly technological war, and how the experience in Iraq is the learning ground for this new methodology of war. And the instruction that they got about this is the ability of the rebellions to adapt technology. With the little few weapons that they had, they were extremely good at the technology of war. And so they were, as resistance fighters, they were very effective. So war and the nature of war is changing. This is the ground where it is being tested, and we will have the triangle now has already been formulated. The question is, how will the administration sell the fact that ostensibly combat terrorism, ostensibly combating terrorism, it actually is carrying out the wishes, the long-held wishes of Israel and Saudi Arabia to check.
Absolutely. Barack Obama has now responded. A day or two ago, he announced he's sending some troops back in, 100, I believe, special forces, or however he put it, but we know what's going on here. Re-escalation, and then they're going to try to throw Syria in, as I indicated earlier in the call. They're going to try to throw Syria in because they need a reason to go into Syria. It didn't work last time. They're hoping people will see, we need to go into Syria because look at what's happening in Iraq, and we should have went in, and now we need to go in. You know, this is all just warmongers wanting more wars. That's all it is, and it's pretty sad. It really
Thanks
is.
A lot. Thanks a lot for your call, DX, and really good points that you made today. Thank you for that. We have to look at what's happening here. The United States has been put in a box. Yes, this is about terrorism, but this also is, and perhaps more so or equally so, the question of meeting the demands and fulfilling an obligation that the United States has and that Israel and Saudi Arabia in particular have compelled it to hold on to. And the heavy lobby here in the United States, the Jewish lobby is very heavy. The Israeli lobby, I shouldn't say the Jewish lobby, the Israeli lobby is very, very heavy. Because what they are fearing, because on the one hand they said, well, Saddam Hussein had weapons of mass destruction, and of course it's all aimed at Israel. Or then came Ahmadinejad, weapons of mass destruction, all aimed at Israel. And then Assad, weapons of mass destruction aimed at destroying the Zionist state. So here is the ample opportunity being given to vanquish all these enemies all at the same time. And Israel is applying pressure like people don't even know. The important thing to keep in mind is that within Israel itself, and we'll get to that next week, within Israel itself is a massive movement forming against the government, equating Zionism with apartheid. And more Jews are saying we will not support a state that conducts this kind of terror against Palestinians. And the fear in Israel is that the successes of these movements, and everybody should be concerned because this business of terrorism is horrible, affecting everybody. But it increased the fear factor that the Palestinians will be emboldened, and they will now have within Israel, they will now have a true revival of resistance to occupation. The pressure is on the United States to take preemptive action. With respect to the Saudis, they just have always been accustomed to renting the U.S. military to fight its war. And we discussed the origins of that war. And so their thing is, look, you are obligated to us by treaty, by obligation and so forth to defend us. And now with the level of investment by the Saudis in the United States economy, should they pull out at any time, we'll be in tough shape. So they have a pretty heavy cudgel that they're wielding. And they are going to be successful between Israel and Saudi Arabia. They're going to be very, very successful at getting the troops, other people's sons and daughters, to go into the sand and to fight wars for their sake. And the question is, how could Barack Obama and the United States as a whole sell that to a public that is sufficiently informed of the lies and misrepresentations over these many years? From Chicago, Henry, you're on the air.
Hey, how you doing, Steve?
Fine, thank you. How you doing there in Chicago?
I'm doing good. I want to talk about something a little different. I'm kind of short on kind of thoughts today, but here's the thing that I've been kind of contemplating with this thing in Iraq that's going on and how it has come to the forefront of the media. So now, all of a sudden, we have this situation going on in Iraq, but the there's a lot of stuff still going on in the Ukraine that, you know, people are kind of ignoring now. So I'm trying to wrap my finger around, you know, why all of a sudden this activity is going on in Iraq, but then there's the same amount of activity going on in the Ukraine, because I think I read somewhere that Russia shut off gas supplies to the Ukraine, which could affect the European economy, you know, big time. So now I also read a recent story where I guess Obama and Putin is going to sit down and talk about the situation within Iraq and Ukraine. And I also read somewhere in the BBC that a former State Department person said that a lot of the Islamist militants, what are they called? The ISIS
yes.
group, right?
Mm-hmm.
Yeah. They said most of them were basically veterans of the Syrian overtake against President Assad. So I thought that was a little interesting, but you know, it seems kind of confusing because the thing with me is that I try to make connections with stories that, you know, were hot, and then next thing you know, here comes another story. And I'm trying to find some connections between, you know, Iraq and Ukraine, because, you know, just about a month ago, Ukraine was the number one thing in the international scene. Now it's Iraq again. So, mm-hmm. I mean, maybe you can clear this up for me. I mean, I don't, you know.
Well, you know, it's about changing interests and whatnot, but it's also that the State Department in very many ways is actually dictating the news. And the priorities of the state are increasingly shaping what we as consumers of information get to know as news. Now, the interesting thing that you raised about the Ukraine, I did point out that shortly after Vice President Biden visited Ukraine when approval, suddenly his son, Bo, becomes an integral part of the largest energy company in Ukraine, just at the time that Russia and Ukraine were supposed to be negotiating rates for gas and other forms of energy. So you see how, in a cynical way, people would say, you're being cynical when you say, so this is what American soldiers are dying for? So that Bo Biden and other folks can have lucrative contracts and could be facilitated to enter into those contracts under the auspices of their politically well-connected friends and family members? Is this what this war is about? Is this why people are dying and their sons and daughters are coming back in body bags and coffins, flag-draped coffins?
Yeah, and you know, and that's the thing about it. You know, the wars in the last decades or so have been the capitalistic movements by the United States, imperialism or whatever ism that you want to attach to it. But yeah, I don't know, maybe it's just me, but I kind of try to make connections between what's going on, because I mean, they're all around the same region. So, you know, there's got to be some connection going on. I always try to figure it out. And
of course there is a connection. There's a connection because, I mean, here's a one simple connection. If there's any country on the planet that has the money to finance a war, it ought to be Saudi Arabia. All right? Mm-hmm. Now, wouldn't it be a smart thing if Saudi Arabia is threatened that it would, you know, rustle up its own army and its own air force and its own navy or whatever else it needs to protect itself? But it doesn't do that.
Mm-hmm.
It rents, you know, American soldiers are dying for Saudi profits.
And Israeli profits, too.
And Israeli profits. But
yeah,
the Israelis are concerned. There's a whole different game going on there where we see that the driving this narrative from Israel, and of course it is mirrored in Saudi Arabia too, that the United States has obligated itself, apparently in perpetuity, to protect these nations at whatever cost. And at some point, the conversation in the United States ought to be, under what conditions are Americans to lose their lives? In defending what? Defending
okay.
what? Especially from countries. The Saudis could buy any number of fighter jets. It could rustle up it could rent its own army. It could, you know, put out a call and get soldiers from all over the world and have its own fantastically well-equipped army and air force and navy. Why doesn't it do that? Why doesn't it pay for its own defense? Why doesn't it fight its own war?
Yeah, that is definitely true. And see, I've only listened to your show a couple of months now, and this is why I listen to you, because you seem to be probably one of the most smartest political analysts that I've heard on the radio today. So, sorry. I just wanted to bring this up because I really just have questions about this. And, hopefully you or some of your callers can clear this up for me and what the connection is between Ukraine and Iraq. And, you've given me some insight in it, but,
Ukraine was the demo project, if you will, about the most recent way in which the United States could flex its muscles against its old nemesis, Russia.
Mm-hmm.
See? And so it could come into Russia's territory and take Russia's territory, and Russia can't do diddly. And so the United States affirms its dominance of the world. Once again, the big boys on the block, we could come into your turf and take your land, take your turf, and we can do it, and there's nothing you can do about it. Reviving the old silly, let's see who could pee higher on a wall kind of mentality of the Cold War. But in the other part of the world, now is U.S. and its peculiar interests. The U.S. is dominating still. But Ukraine was significant in the sense that the United States just wanted to prove to the world that it is, in fact, a world power. It could face Russia down. It doesn't have to back down. It could go and swipe one of Russia's old territories, take it on, and the Russia could do nothing about it.
Yeah. Well, thank you very much. I really appreciate your insight.
Thank you very much, Henry, from Chicago, for calling today. The more you see these things happening and you're being told, you turn on any news medium, they tell you what the news is. But the news is actually framed by interests that have as the number one goal to influence your opinion and to produce predictable reactions. And at a time whenever you hear the chorus of war, the first job of the media is, this is for the military, this is the military's demand, the first job of media is to create a sense of nationalism, a sense of national identity, a sense of setting all criticisms aside and standing behind the president and your government and whatnot. That's the job of media, to create in the minds of the citizens a sense of national pride and identity. And therefore, we set aside all kinds of things that would normally cause us to back up and say, I'm not going to tolerate that, or I'm opposed to that, or I don't believe in that. You set aside belief, you set aside common sense, you set aside logic, and you cling on to the flag, because after all, that's what it's all about, being American. Our American way of life is being threatened. And you hear increasingly that pronoun being thrown around all the time. We, what are we doing? And what should we do so and so? Shouldn't we do this? And shouldn't we do that? And it's the media asking these questions with the we. You want to say, what do you mean? Who is the we you're talking about? You mean the government? At this point, we are one with the government. We are the government. This is the work that is going on now. It's all timed. You can't have the president basically making a quick decision. The feelings and sentiments of the public need to be shaped, need to be brought sufficiently in line with a national sense of togetherness. And when that is significantly achieved, then you go into war and you escalate your war activities, because then people set aside everything else that they normally would question and instead become very concerned about the survival of the nation. And in that regard, they will forgive even the unforgivable. They will forget things that they shouldn't forget. They will remember things that they should forget. You know, all of this is choreographed through the media. The reports that we are getting from the battlefield will be all suggesting that the president, in whatever decision he makes, the president will have made the correct decision because it is in response to these unrelenting reports, one-sided reports that we're getting about what is unfolding in these parts of the world. We will never appreciate, because they won't tell us that part of the story, about the hidden hands, Israel and Saudi Arabia in particular, the insistence of the United States clinging to a policy of what is open warfare, a standing policy of open warfare against any country with which the United States disagrees. And to the point of encoding it as standing policy in the law books. This is the credo of the United States. If we don't like a government, that's the thing, the we part. If we don't like a government, we can take him out. And they use this kind of language, just like in the old Western movies. We can take him out. And media people have no problem asking the question, should we take him out? Should this person be in office? And they're doing the bidding of the government. But hopefully we will see an awakening of the American public, and to the point where it would insist on its role, its vital role of being the checks and balances of outrageous conduct by government. Thanks so much for joining me today. Stay tuned. Coming up next is Wake Up Call with Richard Martin. Drop me a note at leadstories@gmail.com or on Facebook, Lead Stories with Utrice Lead. Let me know how these programs are resonating with you, and have a great weekend. See you on Monday. Bye-bye.